Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark Belfast podcast on our current series, What the Fuck is the Stock Market? This is episode 5. I'm joined again by Sean Byers of Trademark and our comrade over in London, Stuart McGill. Last time we spoke to you, we stopped before we got onto a favourite subject of ours, and that was share buybacks. We're going to kick off with talking about share buybacks, which is a fascinating insight into the capital markets, but also how capital markets change and how they've changed, particularly over the last 4 decades. And what that signals for the state of the global capitalist economy. We're also going to maybe take a wee little segue into a classic Marxist area of conversation on the falling rate of profit, the iron law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, and what that tells us about the current state of the capital markets. Then we may look at, well, we'll have to look at the energy crisis, gas and so on and so forth. We'll have to look at the supply chain crisis, of course. And then we might finish by looking at everyone's favourite capitalist economy, China. And what's going on with Evergrande and the massive property market that seems to be falling apart in China, and what that says both about China, but also about the global system again. And hopefully we'll be able to learn something together. We'll be able to demystify some of the parts of these fairly opaque markets. And yeah, we can all learn something. So look, we'll kick off with that one then. I'll go to you first, Sean, because I know that it's about 4 years ago we kind of first taught this or put it on a slide at a political school. And we were talking about share buybacks we're trying to give an idea to punters what these people were up to, if you like, in the city of London and Milan and New York. And one of the things that came to the fore was this idea of share buybacks, which is slowly coming, I think, to the public, moving the public discourse, but still kind of fairly opaque. So what do you know about share buybacks? What are they, very briefly? And then we'll go on to Stuart about what they tell us about global markets. What is a share buyback?
Well, share buybacks really do what it says in the tin. So company buys its shares that are on the market, which reduces the amount of shares that are on the market and artificially pushes up the share price. And there are a number of reasons why they do this, which I'm sure I'll expand on, but the main reason is to prop up the value of the company and to benefit shareholders. And it also benefits corporate executives. You know, corporate executives, their salaries are tied to the company's value. So there's an incentive there for those CEOs to prop up inflate the company's share price. And it's a practice that was banned in many places. It's a practice that was frowned upon in many places, but it really took off with deregulation of share buybacks in Britain and the US in the 1980s. That's really where it took off. And in particular, it's a massive practice in the US and the biggest stock market in the world.
Do we know how much of it's going on, Sean? Like, was it a fringe activity that's now a mainstream activity of large companies who float their shares on the stock market?
Well, it's gone from a fringe activity to something that is widely engaged in by the top sort of 500 companies on the stock market. The value of share buybacks in the US was something like $5 trillion since 2008, right? Which is massive. There's already $1 trillion worth of share buybacks declared for this year, planned for this year in the US, and $200 billion in Europe. Traditionally, the Europeans have sort of frowned upon the practice, and there's been stricter regulation of it. But it's starting to take off there as well. Apple, for example, they've planned a $90 billion share buyback for this year. A lot of the tech companies are engaging in it. There's lots of companies who don't make any profit at all that are engaging in it, and that's precisely the reason why. So it's becoming a widespread and mainstream practice amongst a lot of the big companies.
Stuart, it's amazing to those of us trying to understand this stuff that something that was once illegal back in, I think Sean said it was the early 80s, it was made legal in various places at different times, obviously, but because it was considered to be market manipulation, the idea that you buy your shares back, therefore the numbers of shares that exist out there and the market's drops, which kind of increases their value. I mean, it's direct market manipulation. We can see why it was illegal, you know. But also, if you're engaging in share buybacks, you're signaling to people in the market, oh, we're not doing very well, by the way, so we're gonna prop up our share price by buying loads of it back. And yet people still engage in that, isn't it? It's almost like, we know you're committing fraud. We know your company's fucked as well, by the way, but sure, look, still, we're going to buy some of our shares back and we're going to artificially increase the price. Hopefully then others will then invest in that company. I'm assuming that's the what they're trying to do at some level. What was your experience of share buybacks when you were in the game? And did you, as I said before, when it went from being a fringe activity now, what it appears to be a mainstream activity within capital markets?
Certainly whenever I was in the game, it wasn't particularly big for British companies to get involved in it. It was an American phenomenon, still is overwhelmingly American, but more British companies are doing it now. In terms of the mentality which lies behind it, there's a study from Graham Harvey and Shiva Rajgopal, which I'll stick up onto the, I'll send to you later. You can go ahead and put on the information for this podcast. They interviewed 400 CFOs of large US public companies. 80% of them said they would sacrifice economic value for the firm in order to meet that quarter's earnings expectations. This is the phenomenon of quarterly capitalism that people talk about. Now, the reality is probably closer to 100%, but it's a bit of a shock that 80% actually admitted it. And share buybacks are a way of keeping the investors happy and, of course, enriching yourself. Looking at some figures here, 465 companies in the S&P 500, they spent $4.3 trillion on buybacks, equal to 52% of net income between 2009-2018. Another $3.3 trillion on dividends, an additional 39% of net income. So this is a big business. And what some people talk about here, and this will maybe take us on to a discussion about falling rate of profit, buyback proponents argue that it's optimal behavior, a reflection of the fact that in today's environment, American corporations don't have promising investment opportunities. So returning the cash to shareholders is the right thing to do. But another study by Illinois University shows that a large share of buybacks occur when a corporation would miss its earnings per share target, if not for the lift provided by a buyback. So they do have opportunities, thus they choose to go ahead and lift the share price because it keeps the investors happy. And to a certain extent, that's a function of the fact you don't want to be taken over and you aren't going to lose your job if you're able to show you've continually raised value for shareholders. So like a lot of things, it's a bit of a function of the ridiculous idea that a company exists only to maximize shareholder value.
So it speaks to that kind of 1980s, 90s culture that emerged in the States of maximizing shareholder value, or MSV, as they call it. That's the primary goal of any. But to be honest, as an outsider looking in, surely that's the goal of all capitalist firms, is to maximize the profits of the people who own it. So if share buybacks do that, even on a short-term basis, I suppose they'll adopt that kind of strategy. The issue, I suppose, is that what does it tell us about the long-term state of that company? That idea of old school patrician companies that last 100 years, they have a 200 year history, like, you know, that's gone. And you have now this vastly complicated and sophisticated and really quick turnover of companies. And it's that casino capitalism idea that you don't invest in companies long term. You just see them as a vehicle to maximize profit, cash your chips in, get the fuck out as quick as you can. I remember I was reading when you sent that stuff through to us about IBM, you know, the biggest firm pre-Gates, I suppose, in computers, and that since 1995, it's spent $200 billion on share buybacks. And since 1999, it's lost 40%, or it's down to 40% of market share. So it's used as a strategy almost to prop itself up in a market that it's losing ground in. And I think in 95, it cut back. 1 year after that, it cut something like 35,000 jobs, and they've been shrinking ever since. And me and Sean were talking about this last year, because right in the middle of COVID, the first major share buyback post kind of the start of the pandemic was IBM. And I didn't realize they'd been at it for 20 years. I just thought this was a response to COVID. But this is just the latest attempt. I think it was they were going to do 10 or 20 billion worth of share buybacks to try and prop up the share price. They did it. And of course, then the share price plummeted. So it didn't work for them. So clearly, this isn't working for everybody. Clearly, it's a short-term strategy. But what does it tell us about the state of capitalism, particularly, you know, Anglo-Saxon capitalism, American, and I include American capitalism in that, that more and more companies are actually using what is clearly a manipulation of the market to pretend to prop up their share price so that they can either cash their chips in, as you said, through dividends or whatever kind of payments they can get, or just a means to pretend that they're doing better than they are. I mean, and I'll refer you to what you wanted to talk about. I mean, does this speak as Marxists, I suppose, you know, we, and if listeners haven't worked out yet, we are Marxists, that, you know, the fact that capital markets are turning to these kind of ham-fisted attempts to manipulate markets and that the entire stock market itself is actually at the moment kind of feeding at the teeth of quantitative easing and state created public money and all the rest of it. It's in serious crisis. And what does it tell us about that iron law that Marx spoke about, the iron law of the tendency of the rate of profits to fall? Is the rate of profit within capital falling globally, and is share buybacks a response to that, or one of the responses to that?
I think it's one of the responses to it. I think it tells you about many things, including the state of competition, because both Samsung and Apple have spent quite a bit, or certainly intend to spend quite a bit on share buybacks. I think one theory is that this is a function of monopoly or oligopoly finance capital. All right, if you had real competition, they'd be spending a little bit more than they do on getting a competitive edge. They don't. They spend a lot of it on bullshit bits of competition, which don't make an awful lot of difference. They spend it on share buybacks to keep the shareholder happy. Also, you have to look at things like the amount of time CFOs and CE and chief executive officers spend in the job these days. Apparently, it's gone down from an average of 8 years 20 years ago to 4 years now. These guys don't spend too much time in there. And so their interest is maximize shareholder value, make sure you don't get sacked, and make plenty of money for yourself. Okay, certainly this was illegal for a long time. I still don't understand why it's not illegal now, because it's classic insider trading. These guys hold shares. So whenever they buy shares back, the company buys shares back, they make an awful lot of dough. I think it shows also the lack of investment opportunities. And there's something I dug out from a presentation I did a little while ago. Give me a second here. This was from Stephen Roach in Morgan Stanley. He's writing this in 2004. He's talking about the substitution of high wage workers here, i.e. America, with like quality low wage workers abroad. And he talked about this as a function, basically getting cheaper labor overseas. In an era of excess supply or overproduction, as we Marxists would call it, companies lack pricing leverage as never before and must be unrelenting in their search for new efficiencies. So that's a Morgan Stanley guy talking in 2004 about what precipitated global supply chains. It's all about squeezing the margins as much as possible so you can extract as much value. Pissing about with various bits of financial engineering is much less risky than investing in new markets or new technologies.
So it all boils down, Sean, does this, to basically short-termism and quick bucks and quick money and using the economy as a means to just make enough, a few billion while you can, and then get the fuck out and buy a house in the Hamptons and a private jet. I mean, that sounds almost too kind of cartoonish to be real. Is it? Is that what these people are actually up to?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what's happening. Coming back to the falling rate of profit, like the biggest advocate of this theory, I suppose, is Michael Roberts. Some people know he runs the Next Recession blog, and he's shown like empirical evidence that the overall rate of profit has been declining in Britain and the US since the Second World War, right? It's on steady decline, you know, it's peaks and troughs, but overall it's on the decline. And, you know, that's forced Western capital in particular to find other ways of making profit. So financialization is one of them, credit, rent, stock market manipulations and other, accumulation by dispossession, so privatizing public services, utilities, natural resources, raiding public pensions, land grabs and so on. So it's just about finding new and other ways of making profit, as Stuart says, without the risk of actually having to invest in real productive activity.
Yeah, it's, I think we use an analogy sometimes when we're trying to teach this to punters. We say that if you can imagine capitalism growing over space and time over the last 250 years, if you imagine a pebble being dropped in the middle of a pond and the ripples go out, that's the birth of capitalism. That's its growth over time and space across the globe. Of course, that involves a little bit of genocide and war and imperialism. And the idea, I suppose, is that now the ripples hit the edge of the pond and is now rippling back in again. And that's kind of cannibalized. Capitalism almost cannibalizing itself, looking, as you said, Sean, for new ways to artificially maintain profits and looking for new kinds of markets. And there aren't too many places left. And of course, that's the attack on the public sector. That's the attack on, as you said, public services and the common good and the public land and all the rest of it. So where can we fucking get money from now? We'll return to that one again, I think, because it's an interesting one. And we'll that the idea of it, whether the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, because it's questioned and it's argued by different Marxists from different perspectives. So not all Marxists agree on that one, actually. So maybe we should have a look at that later on, you know. Go on, Stuart.
I think we can definitely agree there is pressure on corporate profitability, and there's different ways of defining this, and Robert's work has been questioned by a few people, and some people question whether it actually matters as well, which I can understand. But I think I remember God, this is back in the late 90s, one thing I went to whenever I worked for the bank, a Spanish MBA. And he was talking then about the real crisis of oversupply and also about consumer satiation. We all have a lot in the West. You can only buy so many pairs of jeans. You can only buy so many nice pullovers and so on. So you get to that point where people don't want to buy anymore, which is why, again, a bit of a tangent here, if we're serious about doing something about climate change, we have to go ahead and stifle the advertising industry, because they help create all these wants, which makes us buy, keeps capitalism going, and screws up the environment. Last thing on share buybacks, some interesting figures here. In 2015, 2017, in America, the restaurant industry spent 140% of its profits on buybacks, or 140% of the profits. So it dipped into reserves to go ahead and share.
Or it borrowed, as a lot of them do. A lot of these companies are borrowing money to buy their own shares back, further indebting the company as well, which more pressure on the company's profitability.
Oh, yeah, but you can take debt off. You can add your debt interest to your P&L, so you can get some tax breaks on the back of that. But that's another story in itself. The retail industry, nearly 80% of its profits, and food manufacturing firms, nearly 60%. So that's a lot of dosh which has not been spent on the workers, not been spent on investing. You know, this is a real problem, and it derives from regulatory changes in the early 80s, which screwed things up for all of us.
Sean, you want to come in?
Yeah, just on that, I was reading around this just prior to recording this, and I've seen economists and some retail companies, for example, make the argument that share buybacks help to protect them from private equity and hostile takeovers, and that's the primary reason that they're engaged in them. So I just wonder why you think that's a legitimate argument, or is that a cover?
Oh, I think it's legitimate to a large extent. People are very concerned. I mean, private equity is pretty much on the march these days. And people are very concerned. We'll talk a little bit later on maybe about my experience of being taken over. But people are very concerned about what shareholders think of you to avoid takeover. I don't think it's a particularly good thing, all right, but I think it's probably a legitimate explanation of why some companies do this.
Yeah, so they're going into the market to buy back their own shares, so there's less shares for an aggressive takeover from private equity, basically.
Right? Oh, so you keep your own investors happy. All right, not unless we get taken over because we really pissed off our investors for various reasons. So if you wind up enough of your investors and only a relatively small number hold quite a large number of shares, then you're vulnerable.
I'm quite glad I don't have a pension, lads. I mean, I do have a polytunnel and a vegetable patch, which will keep me going for a couple of months at least when the crisis hits, but I'm not, if I had a pension like you lads do, obviously, I'd be very fucking worried with all this chat about fucking global financial crisis. Hey, look, moving on to more global financial crisis, because one of the things that we've had a couple of emails into us about messages is about having a chat basically about these supply chain blockages that seem to be dominating the news and have done for the last 6 months. I mean, I know that the COVID pandemic itself reopened kind of debate about the merits and drawbacks of a really sophisticated and coordinated global supply chain, and that if there's a block in any part of it, then the whole thing can fall apart. I remember it brought it home to me back in 2007. Remember the fuel petrol protests, and there was all these rich Tories and big farmers and other ones blocking fucking petrol stations or producers all around England, and very, very quickly the entire economy ground to a halt. And it just shows you how easy it is for these global supply chains to be interrupted. Now, COVID obviously was a massive interruption in global supply chains. The argument from the establishment and the mainstream is that when China ordered the first lockdown, it started a kind of supply chain contagion, if you forgive the pun. And that's generally the accepted argument. And at some point in the next couple of months, we'll get out of COVID and all the supply chain issues will correct themselves and we'll be back to normal again. Is that the case, though? Or as Marxists, do we have to look at it in a different way? I mean, is there a relation perhaps between how the market works with supply chains, how finance works with just-in-time supply chains as well? I got you first, Joe, on that one.
All right. Okay. So first of all, this goes back to the Japanese car industry sometime in the 50s and 60s.
Kaizen.
I'm sorry?
Kaizen. Mel Corey, our comrade Mel Corey, always used to go to Kaizen, which was the culture within Japanese manufacturers of... That's where that just-in-time thing first appeared, and efficiency within the workplace and having to be part of the company, all that. And it was the only thing Mel knew about global international capitalism was Kaizen, and he brought up every fucking single time we talked about international capitalism. But go on, back to the change
of
Japanese
culture.
It's
a very important thing to know, because it is quite important the way the Japanese operate. And it's became very, very popular. And so companies, again, with the whole view of maximizing shareholder value, worked very hard to go ahead and streamline the supply chain. So rather than have a big warehouse and people operating that warehouse on a regular full-time employee basis, then get rid of the warehouse, all right, get rid of the employees and only employ people whenever you need them, whenever stuff comes in. So,
and that was one of the beginnings, wasn't it, of the precarious workforce, of the workforce that was going to be employed during seasonal activities and seasonal work, even in large-scale manufacturing and industry.
Exactly. Yeah, so this suits them particularly well. And also, in terms of the role of the financial sector in this, I was thinking about this a couple of days ago and our experience in NatWest whenever RBS took us over. The analysts are quite important, financial analysts. They don't get talked about enough, because these are the guys that look at visible aspects of the company's performance and comment on that. Without getting too technical, in NatWest, we had a very low return on weighted risk assets. And this is something which shows up in the accounts. And they commented upon that. And so RBS, as we know, were run by a psychotic and Fred Goodwin, and the financial sector nearly crashed on the back of that. With inventories, if you have a lot of inventories on your stock and you have acquiring interest on those inventories, it's visible. The analysts will see that. So if they look at your report, your accounts, and you're looking fairly fat regarding inventories compared to your competitors, they'll comment on that. And again, you're vulnerable. So a lot of this is driven by what the financial sector thinks about your performance and about those visible aspects of your performance. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, but relate it back to supply chains for us.
You basically cut down your warehousing. You don't bother with all these things here because it looks bad for the analysts and it costs you money as well. So for those two reasons, you get things as narrow as possible and you're able to go ahead and employ casual labour that you don't have to look after, train and pay pensions for, etc. All right. So again, driven by the whole concept of maximising shareholder value and looking good, compared to your competitors.
So Sean, that's another feature then of global capitalist production is that drive for efficiency, that drive to maintain profits. Again, businesses everywhere say, what's wrong with that? It makes perfect sense. The purpose of a business isn't to provide employment. That's just a happy off kind of product for us. The purpose of a business is to make profit for itself. So integrated kind of vertical and horizontal supply chains are really sophisticated and coordinated, makes sense. And it makes sense for consumers because it means things can be ordered and delivered on spot really quickly. You don't have to wait around.
Yeah, but I suppose the downside to that, as we're seeing now, is that those are susceptible and vulnerable to shocks. Like shocks, COVID, which have interrupted production, made it more costly and difficult, and climate-related shocks. And like James Meadway, he's actually quite good on this. He's a couple of articles. I know you can take him or leave him, Stevie, but he makes the point there's too many economists saying these as temporary problems that will be overcome. In fact, they're going to be with us for a long time and probably going to get worse, right? So even in the capitalist press, I've seen in the Financial Times and so on, the Economist, people saying that the past 40 years were about efficiency, maximizing profits, and greater complexity and interconnection. And the next 40 years need to be about resilience, even from their perspective, need to be about resilience and planning and just-in-case production and so on. So from our perspective, we do, we can't remove ourselves from the global economy, but there's an opportunity and there's a need to become more self-sufficient. And that means developing a progressive green industrial strategy, growing localized supply chains, where possible. It's the sustainable, the pragmatic, sensible thing to do. And it's crucial to tackling the likes of the climate crisis.
Sounds as if you're segueing into discussions there, Sean, about state central planning, stuff like that. I mean, that's dangerous ground to me on that.
You're some sort of lefty there, Sean.
that we should be using technology and computerized technology particularly in helping us plan for the things that we need to produce and plan for the things that we need to live on and plan for the things that we need to live on to be delivered to our doors and delivered into our communities. And only a coordinated and democratic planning can achieve that over the next 40 years. But I think absolutely a definite podcast outside of this market one is on the return of the states and the return of state central planning. Not that it ever actually disappeared. We were just convinced that it didn't exist, and we were convinced that it hasn't been happening. The idea that the state has shrunk is, of course, a myth, but it's an important neoliberal myth. But I think we should definitely do one on that because it's one of my favourite topics at the moment. So supply chain crisis then isn't just a short-term COVID shock, is what we're saying, that it's going to be a feature of all of our lives from this point onwards, particularly with the climate crisis coming at us. And that's, we know that that's going to lead to or see the need for massive shifts in how we produce and deliver things. Stuart, do you want to come back in on supply chains? Tell you what I'll do. I'll just segue on to the next bit because it's kind of linked. And that is, we've got another email in to talk about the energy crisis. We all know there's an energy crisis. And here in the north of Ireland, they're talking about a 50% rise in gas bills as an early Christmas present for families here, which is fucking shocking. I mean, the 50% rise, that's going to hurt and hit a lot of people. And those supply chain issues that we just talked about affect the price of energy as well, because a lot of countries have been caught by simply not having enough reserves of gas and oil, because we don't keep reserves because we have these sophisticated integrated supply chains. That's kind of that efficiency thing, but it can't prepare you for a shock. And so shorter that just-in-case supply of energy doesn't exist anymore. And I think the price of oil and gas has gone, or price of oil has doubled or something in the last 12 months. It's gone from 40 to 80 barrels, of course. And I wasn't aware that there's also been another shift in this stuff, which I'll come to you on, Stuart, is that when you think of gas delivery in the industry, I just think of pipelines, country-to-country pipeline. Boom, there it is, nice and secure, a big infrastructure. But that's been superseded to some degree by a new industry, which is a liquefied natural gas industry. Yep. Which I didn't really know anything about, to be honest with you. But now we have cargo containers full of natural gas floating on the oceans and waiting to deliver their products to certain nations. But because it's completely marketized now, they're almost sitting out there, aren't they, on the Atlantic Ocean and Pacific, waiting to see where the highest price is going to come from before they deliver their gas to whichever country. Would that be kind of a fair enough summary of what's going on?
I think that's a good summary of what happened. Basically, the Brits and the Europeans have been outbid to a large extent by the Far East. I mean, for various reasons in China, like there was one problem in a coal mine, and so they introduced some new safety measures there, and they are trying to move away from coal, so they had to get hold of a whole bunch of liquefied natural gas, LNG let's call it, and the demand for LNG from the Far East has been phenomenal, often to go ahead and meet demand from Western consumers and Western industrial firms. We're all integrated on this, and it's made it very difficult for us to get hold of the gas at anything like a price. And because our energy people here haven't been particularly good at securing long-term contracts. They buy stuff on the spot market. So we haven't got a lot of stuff coming through to us at a contract with a fixed price. We buy to go ahead and exploit opportunities. We buy on the spot market, and now we're getting shafted for it. And there's the whole issue of the Russians. There's just some dispute over this, but I think there's no doubt that Mr. Putin has not been supplying all the gas he could to send a message regarding the Ukrainian bypass pipeline.
It's funny, isn't it? It reminds me of, because I remember talking and teaching before about what happened in the 1970s with the OPEC oil crisis and how Saudi Arabia and others just turned off the oil in the in the Middle East to send a very important message to the United States. And when you come in here to the Middle East, you come in as our partner. In fact, under our say-so. And that was the geopolitical background to that. And of course, Putin's doing exactly the same, some are suggesting, with gas supplies into Europe. He's saying, look, I can turn you fuckers off anytime I want, which of course then leads on to that idea of the liquefied natural gas market becoming even more important for nation states to compete over. And as you said, I mean, when it gets cold in China, you know, prices go up in Britain and Germany. That's the reality. I read last week that, I think it was an article you sent through, Stuart, from the FT, that every year China adds between 15 and 20 million people to its gas pipelines, in terms of building new cities and towns. So it's like adding Belgium or Holland onto the international market every year. So it's important. Sean, it's an important one, isn't it? The energy thing. And it's really fucking important, because it's the one thing that can slow down production. It's the one thing that can slow down the entire economy. And of course, we know that capitalism is built on fossil fuels the last 250 years. And now we're saying these fossil fuels, weirdly, because of moves towards more sustainable types of energy, that's actually causing the crisis itself, isn't it? Because now they're trying to use less dirty forms of fossil fuel, if you like, as a kind of middleman before going into green energy.
Yeah, that's the argument. The big fear in China is that their plans for further decarbonisation will be derailed as a result of this. You know, we'll see the steady removal of environmental regulations and a massive increase in coal production, which is obviously not what we want to see. But it does demonstrate how dependent we are, the global economy is on fossil fuels, even though the writing's been on the wall for decades. And even the implications in terms of food production. We're seeing record prices for fertilizers, which are mostly made from gas. European firms are cutting production. There's countries that are banning the export of fertilizers due to this. The food industry will be really hit, farmers will be hit, other energy intensive sectors are going to be hit really badly. I was reading an article in Forbes which made this point, or suggested that this is the explanation for it, Stevie. They blame the crisis on what they call a carbon divestment craze, and they're saying we've gone too far and too fast with decarbonisation. But what doesn't mention is that there's been a serious lack of planning for this kind of situation. And it comes back to planning, as you said, Stevie. There's no long-term planning for this type of situation, despite the fact that we know that these things do emerge and will emerge. There's no long-term planning for an energy transition under public ownership, not in Britain or the other advanced capitalist states anyway, as far as our government's concerned. The states in the Global South have, you know, they have a different set of challenges to face. But the big crime here, you know, like in the West, is that we just haven't planned for this.
And we cut down the storage capacity we had in that rough area. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but let's call it the big rough storage plant. That gave us something like 15 days gas supply storage. Got rid of that. Now we have next to bugger all. And again, that was all about sacrificing resilience on the altar of efficiency and becoming more profitable.
The reality here is that there was a United Nations produced a report yesterday or the day before. I think it's on Trademark's Twitter feed, and it says that governments are, they're not even tinkering around the edges of these energy crises and the potential of future energy crisis. They're still investing in fossil fuels because that's all they can invest in. And they've invested more in the last couple of years in fossil fuels than they have in climate or green energy. And so they're not, as Sean said, we're not at the stage we need to be, or far from it. And probably we're heading towards 1.5 degrees what within 5 years and 2 degrees within maybe 15 or 20 years.
So absolutely.
And alongside the supply chain kind of crises that we're living through, we're also going to be living through energy crises over the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. This is getting really positive and uplifting, isn't it?
You're cheering this all up here, mate.
But the point I'm making is, the point Sean makes, is that none of this stuff is going away. And yet everyone's so stuck in capitalist and neoliberal ways of thinking, they don't realise the only way out of this is through state central planning and international cooperation based around how we democratically plan for a different kind of future. The idea that markets are going to solve this, that's the problem. And too many people believe that no markets can solve this.
Oh, it's just bullshit. Yeah, if you look at something like solar panels, if you buy solar panels, there's a good chance they come from China and they're made with cheap, dirty Chinese coal. China's got the coal. Also, it's a very labor-intensive industry, solar panels, so you need people to handle the very flimsy panels. So China has a major competitive advantage there. So you need some kind of agreement with China. If you produce this stuff with more renewable but more sustainable energy, we'll keep on buying it for 4 or 5 years. All right, so your business doesn't get affected that way. If you do something here to make steel more green, that's good. But China produces something like 50% of the world's steel. So you need an agreement with the Chinese as well. You need a national and an international integrated energy plan. Otherwise, we're screwed. Letting the market handle this is just nonsensical.
Well, there's absolutely fuck all chance of that in the next 5 to 10 years. Here, there's one other market finance angle that I read about in the FT, and it was a lot of hedge funds and trading firms have also gambled heavily on natural gas and stuff. And I read that some of the contracts they've signed are into the 2040s. So, you know, more and more of the stock market is being used to hedge against energy crises. Is that right? And what does that tell us about the future nature of both the prevalence of energy crisis and also the stability of the stock market?
Oh, you're asking the question. They are very concerned about this, and they're going to hedge as much as possible. But when you look at the current plans that United Nations report talked about yesterday, all right, this is massive reliance on fossil fuels. People still expect to be using these because that's what is used now to make profitability. And when you look at something like the plans of Nestle and Pepsi for bottled water production, they're going to expand their markets there into the developing world. And bottled water is a major contributor because of the way it's manufactured and also the waste. But their plans are for that to rise. Meat production, meat controlled by relatively small number of commodity sizes. Meat's a massive polluter. And they plan to go ahead and sell more meat into China, Korea. These places, as they get richer, will want to eat more meat. So the plans of the major capitalist enterprises are directly against those who want to save the environment.
I was up the boozer last Friday, and I live in a rural area in County Down in Ireland, and I was chatting to the mates up there, and they're all farmers, or they all have cattle. And we were talking about, you know, the plans for increasing the herd size, and they were all really excited about the potential of exports to China and so on. And I said, well, as you do realize, the next 20, 30 years, we're going to have to cut meat production significantly. And fuck me, boy, I stopped then, because everyone in the pub just turned around to look at me. Who let this cunt in the fucking room? What's he talking about? But that's the, so there's a connection there between what's happening within the capitalist system and these communities where we live, where people are going, no, that's not going to happen. We're not moving away from beef. We're not moving away from sheep, you know? So that idea of that we're going to have a just transition to a different green future, we're so far away from even beginning that process, is actually beginning to scare the crap out of me.
Okay, most people in most states don't actually recognize the gravity of the problem. I think if people did, all right, then we might get some change. But most people just think it's going to be all right, and I'll keep on doing what I'm doing, because we can all rationalize that which makes us money.
Yeah, good point to finish that particular argument. And we'll get back to that one, no doubt, again, because I've no doubt the energy crisis between now and Christmas and the new year, when it gets very cold in January and February in this part of the world, will continue. Sean, anything to add there, or do you want to move on to the next thing? Right, the last kind of thing we wanted to talk about is something that came up just at the end of the last podcast, and that was the economic threats from China's massive real estate bubble. Their property company, Evergrande, I think the debts are something in the region of $300 billion, and the crisis could, of course, deepen further because they've got to stump up. I think they got a 30-day pass. They had to pay off some of their bonds, bond interest payments, and they've got another couple of days to pay off another $85 billion in bond interest payments. That's basically paying back people who lent them money to invest in property. It looks increasingly, doesn't it? One, how did they get to that stage? And two, it looks increasing, doesn't it, as that China will be stepping in to take over the assets of that company. What do you think will happen? Sean, I'll go to you first, mate.
Yeah, one of the big parts of China's growth story over the past decade has been a major property boom. I read somewhere that at its height, China was building the equivalent of a city the size of Rome every 2 weeks, right? And I saw it. I was in China around 2013. I've never seen as many cranes or buildings, or like half-built buildings in my puff. And we got to the stage where investment in real estate makes up about 10% of China's GDP. And that increases to 30% if you're talking about, if you count construction and you kind of count the other sort of activities that are related to property. Like, so it's massive. It's about double what it was in the US at the time of the financial crisis. So the fear is, as Stevie, as you said, that the Evergrande's going to miss this repayment of $85 billion or whatever it is, or million, sorry, on Monday. It'll go into default, and then it'll spark a sort of Lehman Brothers contagion across the property and banking sector, and lead to a financial collapse. That's the fear. Now, I don't know, but my reading off it is that there are a few reasons why this collapse, if there is a collapse, it's not likely to be disastrous. Like, Evergrande only accounts for 4% of the entire property market in China. So it's not a massive player overall. It doesn't have the same influence or risk, I suppose, attached to it as Lehman Brothers did. I think, as you said, Stevie, the Chinese state controls the property market and the financial sector. It's much easier to intervene and stabilize the situation like it did with the stock market a while ago. And the Chinese government has indicated it might let speculators and big bondholders, especially foreign bondholders, take the hit, and they'll protect, you know, small savers and home buyers. So there is a risk, but my reading off is there's unlikely to be a major collapse like we've seen in America in 2008.
Right, Stuart. So I'm going to come to you on the same question, because, I mean, China's road to socialism has taken a little bit of a detour, you could argue, in the last 10 or 15 years. And I know that Xi Jinping has kind of, he seems to be determined to clip the wings, doesn't he, of private capital. And we talked before on one of the podcasts about certain parts of the market. They basically closed down and said, you can't do that anymore. Is he going to intervene here? Is the Chinese state going to intervene here and let that bubble down slowly? Or are they going to let it kind of go to the wall? What do you think is the prognosis for that, for Evergrande, but also the Chinese property market? And will it have any impact on the rest of the world's economy?
Oh, God, yeah, I think it will have to. I think the Chinese will have to intervene. To go ahead and give it some perspective here, China's corporate sector accounts for almost a third of global corporate debt, which is a fairly staggering figure. And in their property sector, its debt-to-GDP leverage ratio is 159%. The current global ratio is 101%. So this is a massive issue. Chinese corporate debt is a big issue. This Evergrande company has got liabilities of $310 billion, which is more than the combined national outputs of Bulgaria, Croatia, Lithuania, Slovenia, and Estonia. Yeah, this is a big issue. I think Sean's right. It's not going to be quite Lehman Brothers, but if this goes and it affects confidence and people start to go ahead and write down asset values, then we do have a potential problem. And this, to a certain extent, raises the issue here of interest rates go up. What effect will that have on the property market? And given the fact that our banks are about 80% into the property, I think 80% of the bank's book is property related, then we have an issue there as well. So if this can help precipitate some kind of global property crash, then we have a fairly hefty issue as well. And it all gets down to excessive debt and leverage and over-optimistic projections of who's going to buy these houses. I've read somewhere, I think in that thing I sent you, that they have something like 310,000 car parking spaces, which is costing them a fortune to go ahead and finance every year. And again, this has been on the cards for a long time. Some guy was saying back in 2012 that this is a stock which has fundamental problems. And he was right. Now, it took a long time to get there, but they were always building up too much debt and building more houses than people were ever going to be able to afford.
Well, I do remember reading an article way back in 2011 in the FT that after the crash in the West, and people said, well, they're going to introduce new regulation, all this loose lending and these shadow banks that have emerged as unregulated lending, that's all going to stop now. Of course, it didn't stop, it all just moved to China. And so we kind of passed on this problem of this property bubble and property markets and speculative property, particularly being funded by easy money from the West into China. So it was kind of inevitable, I suppose, it was going to hit China. The one thing China has, though, Sean, isn't it? It has the ability to step in and to deflate that bubble in ways that the West could also have done, but refused to do. We still have the debate about whether they knew what was happening, or they didn't know what was happening. But China absolutely knows what's happening around. It's the Chinese state, so it can intervene, can't it, and stop it kind of collapsing.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping has even said publicly, like, he knows that the property market will have to be deflated. You know, that speculation is going to have to come to an end, and they're going to have to find a way of managing it. But that leaves them with big challenges ahead. Like, when it comes to the property market alone, you know, if we're looking at who's going to move into those coast cities, for example, rural migration to the cities has really slowed down and reversed in some cases in recent years. And then there's demographic changes that are happening in China. You know, there's the house buying age, the number of people house buying age is slowing down due to marriage and, you know, fertility, birth rates and so on. So there's all that to manage. And then there's the issue of, the transition or the model of development that China adopts. You know, that's the bigger question. China's talking about, the Chinese government's talking about moving towards what it calls quality development and common prosperity within its current 5-year plan. And that's part of the bigger long-term plan to move to an ecological, socialist, democratic society by 2049, I think it is. But managing that transition is going to be a huge challenge, particularly when you look at the buildup of corporate and household debt that Stuart talks about, and demographic changes and, you know, falling exports and all that sort of stuff.
And also the increased expectations of the Chinese people, whose lives have been dramatically changed in the last 30, 40 years in this, as I said, this Chinese detour and on its road, on this direction of road to socialism. Look, lads, we're nearly going to run out of space there. I hope our listeners enjoyed that. I hope the listeners also, one, realise that there might be another crash, but China might prevent it. But if there is another crash, we've given you the heads up to get down to credit union, get yourselves a couple of grand. You know what I mean? Buy a polytunnel, get the veg in the ground, and you'll be grand, all right? Maybe buy an AK-47 while you're at it in preparation.
I would certainly recommend buying some weaponry, yeah.
With that recommendation, we'll leave it there. Thanks, lads. We'll see you again next time. If you have any questions, please fire them in to us on our Twitter or Facebook page if you want us to address any particular aspects of the markets. And we'll see you next time. Okay, that's us. Slagerfoil. That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and Slagerfoil.